Hi, this is Peter Sarsgaard from Kelly Reichardt's movie Night Moves, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartok, your host of Film Wax Radio, the independent film podcast interview show. Today's a nice jam-packed episode. It's number 304. And the first guest today is going to be Joshua Oppenheimer, who has been on this episode before. Back in 2012, Josh was on the show with his film, The Act of Killing, which, of course, was subsequently Oscar-nominated. The Act of Killing is a documentary about a number of surviving thug killers who also happen to be top-level government officials in Indonesia, who were responsible for the deaths of just thousands of innocent people. They were accused of being communists and just as dangerous, and then were just massacred by the officials. The Act of Killing actually meets up with a number of those officials who, as I said, are still alive and well, and in many cases still in power. And it follows them and interviews them and has them do reenactments and strange musical numbers. It's a bizarre, chilling, devastating film. It was Oscar nominated. It didn't get the top Oscar, but we talk a little bit about that in this coming interview in just a couple of moments. That came out in 2012, and you can look at episode 150 if you want to go back and listen to that. But this episode, Josh is back with The Look of Silence. This one, the synopsis is described as such, and I did see the movie at, I believe it was at the New York Film Festival last year. The family of survivors discovers how their son was murdered, as well as the identities of the killers, perpetrators of the 1965 Indonesian genocide. The documentary focuses on the youngest son, an optometrist named Adi, who decides to break the suffocating spell of submission and terror by doing something unimaginable. Which is to collaborate with Oppenheimer. You know, and it's just a very moving, I think as outrageous and unbelievable a film as The Act of Killing is, The Look of Silence kind of shifts a little bit and calibrates a little into very, very upfront, emotional, first-hand kind of account of the... And so you might have a very different feeling if you went to see The Act of Killing. This is as tough to watch in many ways, but it's also much more personally moving, I think. And it opens Friday. I'm on the lookofsilence.com here, and let's see. Oh my goodness. This film, which you're going to hear a bit of the trailer in just a minute, but the film is opening in New York City on July 17th, in just a couple of days, at the Landmark Sunshine. Josh Oppenheimer will be around for Q&As at the 7 o'clock and 9:45 shows on Friday and Saturday, and after the 4:35 and 7 p.m. shows on Sunday. So welcome back home, Joshua Oppenheimer. The film opens on the 24th of July in Los Angeles at the Landmark New Art. Josh will be there for a number of screenings there as well to do Q&As. It will also be opening at the University Town Center 6 in Los Angeles the same day. A week later, it opens up in Berkeley, in Boston, in Denver, Colorado, in Philadelphia, San Diego, and on and on. And then in August, it just continues all over the country. So this summer, thanks to Draft House Films, The Look of Silence, do not miss it. Also on this episode, after Joshua Oppenheimer, my conversation finally with Mark LaFia, who is a Brooklyn-based artist, filmmaker, writer. This is Mark LaFia works with photography, narrative, new media, computation, and the moving image to consider the image in its many modes and institutions. In all of these works, he explores the limits of image, of narrative, of art, of knowledge, and sense-making of media. You should really just explore his website and find out all the amazing things that Mark is involved with. He's a sweetheart of a guy, and I find him thoroughly fascinating, interesting, funny, and delightful. And so you're going to hear from Mark LaFia in just a little bit in our second segment. The third segment takes me back to last March when I was in Austin, Texas, talking to various local actors. These are Heather Kafka and Johnny Mars. Johnny was on an episode way, way, way back in the day, and he's back for his second episode. And this is Heather's first episode on Film Wax Radio. And together, they're old friends. They've worked together. They're both constantly engaged and involved in filmmaking, not just in Austin, which is a hotbed of filmmaking, of independent filmmaking, but also in L.A. and other places. And I've been sort of holding on to this for the right moment, and it just feels right to put this one out there now. So that'll be the third segment. So let's go right into my conversation with filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer and his film, The Look of Silence.
Ida, saya menganggap itu tidak besar.
Bagaimana mungkin tidak besar? 1 juta orang dibunuh atau lebih.
Soal dia politik.
Jadi kepiye mak perasaan imam mak tinggal cerok di antara pembunuh anak imam.
Kalau kita kaji dulu begini, 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 kita ingin dulu. Wah, udah payah kalau kejadian seperti dulu. Pasti akan kejadian.
How are you, Josh?
So fine and nice to see you again.
Same here. And I don't know if you recall, but we ran into each other like for a second in the lobby of the Hyatt. Is it the Hyatt on King Street?
In Toronto.
In Toronto. And it had flashed through my mind last night as I was at your Q&A or on the way home. Wait, I was remembering our running into each other, even though it was like for a few seconds. But you introduced me, I think, to Adi.
Yeah,
The
right.
Subject of your film. And I realized that, oh my gosh, I remember him now. He was this very sweet, quiet, and thoughtful guy who was there, you know. And how did he find the whole experience? You mentioned last night that I think that's why, because you said last night in the Q&A that he had gone to several of this premiere, and then I put it together. Oh, that's right, I met him. So how did he do on this festival circuit?
I think it was a really important experience for him and for all of us. Adi, Adi arrived Adi makes this film in part because as a response to the trap of silence and fear that his family's been in here, they've never been able to talk about the events that have destroyed his parents' lives, really. And finally, he's up there on the film finishes and the applause comes and Adi will stand up and invariably people give him a standing ovation to honor his courage and the film that he's brought them. And suddenly he's expressing all this that has happened to his family and getting this loving reaction. And I think it's healing. It's the beginning of a process of healing.
Absolutely. Oh, how could it not be? I mean, one of the things about what's been going on with these people is the families of victims, I guess. Victim. The word victim has now become this bad word, so I kind of hesitated to use it.
But you're killed, you're a victim. Yeah, so yeah. Families of the dead, they're victims.
Yeah. Okay. So to know that more than just hearsay, that you've got the heart of the people out there in the world, like in your corner, yeah, how could that not be healing, right? You know, it's
at the same time, of course, it doesn't put right what is broken.
No. And I'm not saying
wake in the dead doesn't put whole the lives that are destroyed. But it was very moving for Adi, and Adi would sit through the film always and watch the whole film. Every time, I think he watched it over the course of the Venice Film Festival, Telluride Film Festival, and Toronto Film Festival 5 times. And he would go stand up at the end, and when the applause would start, he would always break down.
He would
break down and need, out of maybe shyness, need to hug me because we'd be on stage together. And that would last at Venice at the world premiere. It lasted 10 minutes, actually 10 minutes.
The hug.
And the audience, I was whispering to him, Adi, whenever you feel ready, we'll leave the cinema because there's no Q&A in Venice. And finally, he after 10 minutes, he left, but the audience was standing and applauding him for the full 10 minutes. It was an amazing experience.
Yeah. I was going to say this towards the end, but let's talk about it because we will get to, of course, you know, The Look of Silence and talk about it. But I do want to get to something that I've noticed, and that is, as the person is bringing, you know, the act of killing had a huge impact because it was seen by so many people. You couldn't ignore it in Indonesia or anywhere. When a film is nominated for an Oscar and when it gets that much, just, you know, response out there, and a lot of people have seen it, they can't really hide in the shadows anymore. And by them, I'm talking about the perpetrators and the government, who are the perpetrators, right? They're still in power, the same thugs that were responsible for mass genocide. But it appears that you're very cautious in terms of the amount of positive attention you're getting as a filmmaker, as an artist also, and you don't want to deflect attention from the film, from the people in the film. It must be very difficult for you in that way, because you're getting also a lot of love. You're getting a lot of major amount of energy coming from audiences and from people who want to thank you. And yet you have to take that on carefully, I suppose, right?
Well, I think that you try and, you know, if someone from an sees the film and is touched and overwhelmed, to respond to that love with love is the only human thing to do. It's a moving thing that people come out of the movie and are either of the films very moved. I think that the most important thing, though, is you have to understand what is the attention good for. When the film was nominated for an Academy Award, we knew that it's unlikely we win, and we actually get the Oscar. But that, so what do we do? And if we get the Oscar, what does it do? Well, the reason I would care is because it would make it that much harder for the Indonesian government to ignore this if the act of killing wins an Oscar. So, but because we know we have only a 1 in 5 chance of getting the Oscar, we felt, let's make sure we use this opportunity, no matter what, to deepen the impact, because that way you can't lose.
Mm-hmm.
So when people talk about Oscar campaigns, our campaign was about getting the government to acknowledge that what happened was wrong, and then to push that forward as much as possible. So we held screenings on Capitol Hill for lawmakers, urging them to declassify documents pertaining to the 1965 genocide, and we're still engaged with that process.
There was no reason why they were still. They were just hadn't been declassified, maybe.
I think there might be reasons. I think that...
Culpability?
Yeah, there's culpability, because we supported the genocide, and we directly aided the killers. That's actually a crime.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
But we've committed and declassified records pertaining to many crimes.
Yes,
and
very true.
We as the United States enjoy impunity for our crimes, torture. The policy of torture, a very recent crime, is in violation of international law. It's also the law of the United States, federal law, because we've signed the treaties and international conventions pertaining to torture, and we enjoy total impunity for torture. And no, we do. We know we do.
Mm.
We know we do. So there's resistance. I mean, there are people who in the government look after not publicizing our crimes,
right?
Even though, in fact, no one's going to punish us for them.
I saw The Look of Silence last night, and I guess I was somewhat prepared, because I had seen The Act of Killing. I've also heard great things, and I wanted to see it in Toronto, but I postponed to New York, thank goodness, and got to see it last night. And very emotional. I want to explain to people listening, this one has a emotional territory there. Film lovers or audiences that maybe are somewhat put off by something overtly political, but this one also has this real emotional terrain there, because not only do you have the brother of a very infamous victim, right, a well-documented victim, Romley. His brother is the subject of the film. His name is Adi, and we referred to him before. The parents, who are very elderly at this point, they're around a century old, we've learned, and they're just such full, amazing characters. Even the dad, who barely speaks in the film, but for some reason, maybe because of the amount of close-ups or because of just letting them, giving them space to be, and they're just so moving. Yeah, I mean, by the end of it, the mother
is... glimpses of something wondrous with the father, you know.
Yeah.
We have Adi ask him, can you still sing?
Right,
I guess we understand, he must have used to sing a lot in the past. He must have sung a lot in the past. And the father says, because he can't hear, can you sing that still? Right. And he says, yes, I can. He says, well, then sing. And the song that comes out is, you're so sexy, I can't stand it.
Yeah.
And you don't expect a 100-year-old man to sing that, even though we learn that in his senility, he thinks he's only 17.
That's right. So it may actually make more sense that he would choose that song.
Yes.
That would remain in his...
It's age-appropriate.
Yeah. That's right. He's very hormonal in his pubescence. Anyway, so yeah, and the mother, too, this amazing... What an amazing person, and what an amazing... You know, you can correct me if you don't want me to bring it up because of... You know, maybe it's a bit of a spoiler or something. I don't know. But there's... throughout the film... By way of explanation, Adi confronts a number of perpetrators that were all in some way responsible for the death of his brother, as well as, of course,
many
tens of thousands, countless others, people accused of being communists. And it didn't matter what was the truth, because even if they were communists, it's okay. But they were all murdered. And one of the most notorious ones was his brother. So he goes to talk to a number of these people, which, you know, that in of itself, there's lots of questions. But there is a scene where he confronts even his uncle, whom he obviously has a lot of tenderness for. It's not even that.
In fact, he doesn't really go to confront him. He just goes to test his eyes.
Oh.
And then finds out over the course of the discussion that his uncle was involved.
Oh, he didn't know that he was.
We didn't know that.
Oh, okay. I don't know why I thought I don't remember that part. Like, I remember all of a sudden he said, you were a prison guard, right? But he didn't.
No, he says you were here, living around here. What do you remember of the time?
Oh,
and then he
says,
I was guarding the prison.
Okay. What was really scary is he seems to, go into a certain amount of, you could sort of see it, that Adi is all of a sudden terrified of what he might find out from his uncle. There's that. And then he goes home to confront his uncle's sister, who is his mother, who we already know and love by this point, as I say, or have affection for. There's a very, it's almost a scary moment to me. I found it very scary because the mother's now being confronted about her brother, but, you know, we're almost terrified to find out maybe she knew something, which it seemed very unlikely, by the way, because you could see her life was destroyed by what happened, but that she didn't know that her brother had been, even, you know, by association. I mean, he was a prison guard, but he was part of the number of people that...
Suppose I have a slightly different reading of that scene where he tells his mother, I have a feeling, or I've always felt, that his mother must have known that her brother was guarding in the prison. And as she says in the scene, anyone who was guarding there was involved with everything. The hauling out of the prisoners, the dispatching of them to be killed. She says, she insists again and again, I didn't know. I didn't know. I never knew. And I have a feeling that at first Adi's wondering, maybe she never knew. Maybe she knew but couldn't live with this reality. She had to continue living in that community. She had no, her son was killed. She needed her brother's love and support as her brother. She couldn't allow herself to take in this
suppression.
She couldn't acknowledge this horrible fact. And then the mother continues saying, I never knew. And then there's this look on Adi's face, I think, which to me feels like doubt, like perhaps I've gone too far. Maybe I shouldn't have...
Mm-hmm.
confronted my mother with this fact.
You're in this position, unique position, of course, as the filmmaker. You're watching the whole beginning, from the beginning to the end. We're catching whatever you choose to edit into the film. So it's an interesting...
Well, it doesn't mean that I'm right. How I feel about it.
Well, you also have more hours and more time with these people, and maybe get to understand them. Not necessarily as it pertains to the specific thing I brought up, but it's interesting because at the time, obviously, overwhelmed by stress and pain, and then to try to process your brother's culpability in that, it was not, you know, it's easy. Anybody would rationalize whatever they rationalize,
and easier not to go there. It's not,
it wasn't an intentional thing.
And she had this awful experience of the killers. Her son managed to escape from his own being murdered and get home half, very almost mortally wounded, and she's looking after him. And then the killers come to get him from the house, and she's forced to turn over her chin. What she has to do is give the killers, her son, to be killed. She has to, because otherwise they'll kill the whole family.
Oh, yeah, they'll kill him anyway.
And they terribly make this easier for her by lying to her, saying, we're going to take him to a hospital to be cured, healed. And presumably, I feel she had to force herself in that moment to at least partially hope that that was true.
Of course.
So that she could do what she had to do, which was to hand over her son to be killed. But that then afterwards, as she realizes, of course, it wasn't true, which she says again and again in the film. It's almost like a kind of echo in her mind. Of course they weren't taking him to be killed, to the hospital. Of course they weren't taking him to the hospital. It's like when she realizes that, she feels also the terrible sense of guilt that she's somehow complicit by simply accepting that explanation when she had in her heart knew it was a lie. She became complicit to herself in the murder of her own son, which of course she wasn't at all. But I think that made what Rohani, Adi's mother, went through particularly traumatic and something that she has never been able to work through.
Mm-hmm. Has she seen the film?
She actually hasn't yet seen the film.
Mm-hmm.
Adi has been talking about how he wants to show her the film. She's very hard of hearing now, so there was a lot of thinking about and she can't read.
Oh.
So subtitles won't help.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of thinking about right now that we're going through, how can we show Rohani the film?
Yeah.
And Rukun, her husband, passed away in 2013 while we were editing the film.
Mm. Well, and do we ever know his age for sure, other than the 17-year-old
No, his ID card would have made him 104 when he died.
And that's very possible. Seems like longevity is a...
In that family, they're doing... Yeah.
On both sides, obviously. And as an extension of that, Adi, obviously he's seen the film the first time. Did he have a particular reaction, or did he, that was...
Adi and the whole family, we showed them the film. While we were shooting the film, there was a discussion about how in order to make this film, if they want to really continue, not make the film, but if they want to do what Adi wanted to do, which was to confront the perpetrators, the family would probably have to relocate, at least for a while, to protect their safety.
Yeah.
When we had a rough cut of the film, we got together in Thailand because I couldn't safely go back to Indonesia, and spent 2 weeks showing them the film, discussing any concerns they had about what's in the movie, but then also discussing how we make the best of this terrible situation, an unfair situation that they should have to relocate. So we had 2 weeks of him seeing the film then, and then of course, and his first reaction was he was so moved by it, as was his wife. His children have not seen the film.
Well, they're...
And then, of course, he saw the film at all the screenings.
Yeah, yeah. And that was another level to it, right? We see him, in turn, watching his perpetrators on film, what have you, on a TV at home, and then also alternating with him actually visiting a number of these people. And so, but while we're watching him, in both cases, actually, there seems to be what I would call, and maybe some people might look at as being stoic, but again, it could just be a level of like fear, anger. Who knows what someone's going through? We expect them to be there, and the red faced and crying at the and all these reactions that we're accustomed to, but have really no idea how to process. Because we can't. It's hard to read him much of the time.
I think that it's one of the strengths of Adi as a character is that he is.
It worked to his advantage.
Yeah, I mean, he is hard. Is that he gives space for the audience to imagine what he's feeling. And that means we're making the film, you're making the film when you watch it with me. That will make the film much more involving and make him much more involving to you. But I think that the truth behind Adi's many expressions when he's watching the old footage of the perpetrators demonstrating how they killed his brother and when he's confronting the perpetrators is a kind of thoughtful curiosity and empathy mixed with devastation and rage. And I think we see all of these emotions at different times coming to the fore. And of course, it's a big part of how we got away with those confrontations. I think the perpetrators are expecting us expecting Adi to attack them, to get react with fury, and then that would give them an excuse to respond with the language that they know best, which is violence and anger. And then instead of responding with violence and anger, instead of responding with anger and instead of attacking them, he responds with this kind of empathy and dignity. And that, of course, is disarming to the perpetrators. They don't, they don't know that language. They don't speak that language. They're thugs and they're killers in the past. And so they know how to speak the language of force. And he's speaking something like the language of peace, actually. And they don't know the language. And so they don't know how to respond.
Mm.
They do eventually respond with threats, but we had feared they could respond with much worse, and we were prepared for much worse.
And also that whatever tactics they're employing, that don't seem to work. So it's and they don't know how to they're, right. So other than taking out some sort of, you know, club or something, they're sort of at a loss, you know, how to respond to this this person. You mentioned before that you can't go back to Indonesia, which is understandable. However, there is a switch, a change coming up of leadership there. There's some indication that it might be, it can't get worse. I mean, that's for sure. I mean, we would think anyway. Do you sense that, or do you have a wait and see attitude about ever being able to get back into the country?
I'm optimistic that one day I'll be able to go back. I'm hoping that the new president, Jokowi, actually sees the film and likes the film and may help us. I even dream that he may host a screening of the film, and if he would
that's
do that...
That's ambitious of you, right?
Yeah,
that's
it's nice. Ambitious it's because good to be his ambitious. Vice president is in the act of killing.
Right. Yeah.
It's ambitious.
He's a perpetrator.
As a perpetrator, and I think that's fair. My understanding of him is that he was involved with what's called Angkatan Nampulunam, that 66th generation, the movement of anti-communist activists who worked with the military to implement... Mm-hmm. the repression, the purge against the left in 1965-66. But I hope that I have a hope that Jokowi and will, if he does respond positively to the film, will not only use it to strengthen the case for truth and reconciliation, but will also perhaps guarantee my safety for a visit in the not too distant future. If not, I'm still hopeful that as the younger generation sees this movie and avails themselves of the space that has in part been opened by the act of killing to discuss these issues honestly, that things will change, that there's a cultural shift that will take place, and that even if the thuggery and the corruption doesn't entirely disappear, that I will be able to return.
Carol, that could catch on. You want to be careful. You don't want too much freedom and human rights because it can catch. So last, real quick.
You have one more.
No. Well, I'm holding on to this for the summertime, but it's, as far as we know, Draft House is going to release this in the summer of 2015, right, in the States here. And so maybe you'll be back from Denmark, where I know you live. Maybe you'll come back and maybe you can do something else. I don't know. I'll ask. But and you can bring Werner and Errol with you. I wouldn't stop it. What I'm saying, so if you can make that happen.
Didn't you have one more question?
Oh no, I don't have anything written down. If that's what you
no, because you said I have just one more question, or was that?
That might have been. I may have been. I've ended on a little note of levity, maybe. But unless I'm leaving, can you think of anything that
no,
that might?
I just thought I was sort of waiting, and then I was like,
"Oh, I was going to say." By the way, one thing. No, there was to plug. No, and also to kind of insert that you have again executive producers Errol Morris and Werner Herzog, and just that. If you get the nominate, what I would suggest is backup singers. It's just a suggestion.
It wasn't a problem.
No.
I was so honored to be nominated.
I know.
And it made such an impact in Indonesia. And
sure.
Maybe it would have made a bigger impact if we had got the Oscar. But we also knew, I knew, maybe the public didn't and maybe the Indonesian government didn't, but I knew that this issue wasn't going to die with not getting the Oscar, because I knew there was another film right around the corner.
Right. Keep them coming, Josh, by the way.
Thank you so much.
You're a great filmmaker, and I thank you for coming on the podcast again.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here.
Again, you can go to lookofsilence.com and get all the details to where you can see the Look of Silence in your U. They also have a Facebook page. You can track everything going on there as well. But whatever you got to do, get over to the theater and see it. Okay, so let's see. Mark Lefevre was on an early episode before I was even podcasting, when the show was on Bebox in Brooklyn, where it was an internet, very new internet radio station that Filmwax Radio was involved with. It was just one of the shows on that platform. One of my earlier guests was Mark Lefevre, and he's a local Park Slope guy. Although he spent a lot of time out in L.A., and he has constantly got his hands in so many different disciplines of art making. You know, he's always trying to push the limits of media, and very few people do it as well and as charmingly as Mark Lefevre does. So this here right now is my conversation with Mark Lefevre. Even though I like the concept of people having a choice between how they digest certain content, let's put it that way. You know, I have always think, why do we have to have a conversation where it's where you can have vinyl or digital? Where it's like, okay, we have a better technology now. Let's get entire all your vinyl collection, because it's now inadequate. There, I said my bit. How are you, Mark?
Good. I'm good. I'm happy to see you.
I'm happy to see you.
It's like kind of so fun. You could bring your studio with you.
Yeah. Well, I don't have a studio anymore.
Okay.
Which I would love to. Yeah. No. Right. That's true.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's true. There is that element of it. I would like to, but I also want to explore what the other option is of running around and being in people's places and being in different types of environments and locations, what that can offer that having a studio doesn't, you know?
Yeah.
Because it really is like, so I've kind of started to think about documenting it in a certain level, and I, you know, like a photograph of something in every place, you know, I should.
Yeah.
So I was very grateful when I got your email. And because I had this real loyalty, I like to, you know, enjoy of if you've come on, and you're always in, you know, I'd love to have everybody back. And, you know, of course, that number has increased quite a bit. I think you were on, I don't know, the first, at least in the first 20 episodes that I ever did.
Huh.
You know?
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How's it going?
It's going well. I mean, it's grown quite a bit, you know? And maybe inviting you back on is a way of keeping a you know, a through line going, though. So it's still the show it was, but it's also so evolved too. How about you?
Well, I showed this film at Anthology 27.
Yeah,
which is the last film in I think it was
2010.
No, I showed this
more recent
last. 3 weeks ago.
Oh, that so the newer film.
Yeah.
And what's it called?
27.
27. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How'd that go at the film anthology? It's a perfect home, of course.
We showed it in, was it late November, and they invited us back to show it again, and they put us on the big screen, and
that's
it
nice.
Played really well.
The upstairs room.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
There's so much history at that theater, right?
Yeah.
Did Mr. Meckes, was he there?
No.
Yeah.
No.
It's like when you go up, like I screen films up at the Maisel Cinema. And
yeah.
I've seen, you know, Albert up there many times, but not for one of the screenings I've done, you know. But it's got a lot of history there, too. And of course, you know that also anybody who shows up, they're going to be real into it. That audience is not just because something sold out at the multiplex. They're not going to go to the film anthology. People that go there are going there for a very, you know.
Yeah, it was a very good Q&A.
They love that, what you do.
Both times had real like engagement with the picture, so they it's a good audience. Yeah.
So that was your second screening of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And where else are you taking? There's a young woman walked into the room.
Hi,
that
Lola.
Was very thoughtful of you.
You're so sweet.
Hi.
Thank you.
You're Lola.
Lola, take a photo. That's my daughter.
Oh.
This is Adam.
How are you? Nice to meet you, Lola. And right, it's the public. The schools are out this week, right?
Yeah.
Fortunately.
Thanks, Lola.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Actually, thanks for the service.
In the movie, the 27 movie.
Great.
Yeah.
Oh, she's beautiful. Congratulations. As I can attest to, it helps to have a very beautiful mother, too. Because, I mean, you know, speaking for myself. So you really keep busy. I mean, I just had on the current episode that I just put up, DJ Spooky, Paul Miller. Do you know Paul?
Yep.
And you guys are kind of as restless and ADD afflicted. You know, what are your disciplines that you work in?
I've been doing these independent films.
Right.
And been doing a lot of large prints, paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow I go to Italy to do a fashion shoot that I'm shooting.
Is this loosely related to Fashion Week, or is it
separate thing?
Are you going to Milan?
I'm a designer. I'm going to Milan.
Yeah.
Yes, for this one. So I don't know what my disciplines are. Life, trying to keep busy.
All right.
Do stuff.
That young lady, that's a discipline, right? Parenting.
Yeah.
Well, I ask because, you know, there's an appetite for just being involved, really engaged in different things and at different levels of creativity as well as time and effort it requires, you know, right? So he said something interesting, which he said, well, you know, if you insert a lot of semicolons and periods and commas and into your work and your approach to your work, it helps the rhythm of how you do all you do, because it sounds like you're doing a lot, right?
Yeah.
Has it always been that way?
When
you were growing up, and where was that, by the way?
I was born in Philadelphia, so
that's
where I spent my childhood
in the city of Philadelphia,
just outside the city. Yeah,
yeah. It wasn't quite suburban, or is it?
It was right on the border.
Yeah,
yeah.
Was it like on the south side? Like how close to the south side of Philly was it?
Side.
Okay.
Yes.
So you had but it's because that's a real city, Philadelphia, you know? And then when did you start to really explore the arts? Like,
when I was an undergrad and then I went on to the UCLA Film School, which was right next to the art school. So I did my master's there and more I was going between the film school and the art school.
You mean like painting and sculpture? And
well,
kind of
the I was doing more at the art school. I guess everyone I did had that bug for a lot of history and theory, and did a number of classes on painting. And I'd done a number of classes as an undergraduate. So the film school had a production area and it had a history critical studies area.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of overlap between kind of the critical theory and
practical application.
Discourse and art.
Oh.
I started to explore things.
You said UCLA?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Okay. Well, so by the time you graduated undergrad, you were already self-identifying as an artist?
Not really. That didn't come so easy for me because I don't think filmmakers think of themselves as an artist.
Not then, anyway.
Yeah,
No. Unless you were in Hollywood, there was no term or language around what these other people did, even though you were.
Well, cinema becomes very interesting to fine artists with the VCR in the beginning of the 90s and on into the later 90s. And then installation, multi-screen, even like I'm doing these computational films by 2002, 2003. So it moves very much beyond that early phase of video art. It becomes both in the fine art, the idea of images, pictures become more seductive, more of desire than they, let's say, post-conceptual art.
Mm-hmm.
So then cinema becomes a big part of an art practice. It starts becoming much more fluid to move, whereas I think when I was in film school in the late 80s, you're still, the world of cinema and the world of art are not talking to each other. There are film directors that would consider themselves artists.
Right.
In a certain way.
Right.
But not they're not artists in the way they are visual artists or fine artists. They're artists because they have an integrity and make great pictures, you know, but they're not.
Yeah. Though it was around that time when there were some emerging, right, where there were some filmmakers that were coming from less of a, let's say, linear narrative structure and much more of an experimental.
Oh, those guys were long before then. I mean, yeah. the Menkes, the Stan Brakhage,
and all those guys. You know,
Hollis Frampton, all those structural materialist films, Michael Snow, they'd already,
That was
right
kind of
there.
Out of the 50s and 60s, maybe?
Yeah, 60s, okay. 70s, yeah. Okay. I guess I'm thinking about people who are sometimes even working in Hollywood. You know, and... Or I guess I'm speaking more about the arts taking up cinema as a subject, as artists.
Right.
It becomes an area that they're interested. They play like Christian Markley really is remixing the cinema, or there's more. Mm-hmm. And then even on the other side, I guess Mike Figgis does that film like in real time with four screens. So you start getting a bit more
somehow
Peter
marketed
Greenaway,
as a mainstream film,
getting more.
Right? Yeah,
the art is pushing into some of mainstream film, and certainly the interest like Douglas Gordon and others have in cinema is pushing into the art world.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And so then you moved to New York, and
I stayed in Los Angeles. I was in the Writers Guild. I was very much like a struggling screenwriter,
really?
Film director, trying to make it work. I wrote early versions of Iron Man, Judge Dredd.
So you weren't kidding when you wrote me that note about you had definitely gone through that.
I did a lot of videos with David Fincher, the director, with Madonna, Michael Jackson, Janet Jackson, Sting.
Never heard of them.
Meatloaf, all these, Bjork, and but then I got a real bug to go to Silicon Valley. So I went to Silicon Valley and I started. I was very interested in the possibility of nonlinear media.
That, right.
Everything that had interested me in literature and film was this idea of things that were open-ended, things that were nonlinear, things that didn't necessarily have, like Godard said, they had a beginning, a middle, and an end, but not necessarily in that order. That the possibility of that in this new digital space really interested me.
What was the thing that captivated you initially about the going to Silicon Valley? Was there something that happened, or was it, Windows?
I was teaching at Art Center, and I had some really excellent design students.
Yeah.
And that was just at the rise of the internet. It was already kind of coming on in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And again, because I like things like John Cage and Julio Cortázar, and I guess I was always interested in the form, the shape of things, the architecture of a system. So I eventually made like a film projector and software that could be variable. So how can you take this apart? Mm-hmm. So we know cinema could have, their Abel Gance had a three screen cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And, we got a mise en scène that was shot followed by shot in this linear one screen cinema. Mm-hmm. We don't have a multi-screen vernacular for mise en scène. I played with this later on when I started building these patches of different kinds of projectors for cinema. Anyway, I went to Silicon Valley only because I had made some demos for a new way to kind of navigate this space that was both linear and associative. So you could move around in this continually opening space, if you like, this digital space, this computational space, in a new way. You could navigate this space. And that really interested me. So over time, I founded a company there called Art and Culture. And it was pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought me closer to the art world because it was all about the arts and the relationship of the arts and saying, maybe there's a relationship between an urban planner and a choreographer and Dos Passos, the writer. We could find certain thematic and conceptual approaches to the medium that let's say maybe you don't know much about contemporary microsound or Zanakas or contemporary music, but you know some things about contemporary painting. And if you think about it and you look at it, there's actually strategies that the artists take between them that are very mm-hmm. similar, so that you could leverage knowledge about one thing and bring it to another by understanding, well, how's it working? What's happening? What are these? So that got me really
turned on.
Yeah.
What's an example? Can you give me like an example of that? Like a painter, for instance, and
John Cage.
Yeah.
Okay. So you mm-hmm. have him who's into silence, and then you have Rauschenberg take a painting of de Kooning and he erases the painting. Or then you have Rauschenberg interested in doing a multi-screen installation, so that it's like the total performance work, immersive work. So then you have like Robert Wilson, who brings a kind of mm-hmm. minimalism to the theater. And then you have a kind of a Peter Kubelka bringing minimalism to cinema.
An influence that's coursing through those people, and they're inspired.
Yeah,
and
then the project of the modernist to kind of reduce to the materiality of a form. So what's essential to this particular to your medium, if you like? What is it?
Mm-hmm. And that's usually a reaction, not surprisingly, to what's going on in the world around them too.
Yeah,
like the minimalist feeling of or something other than that, whatever it is, right? It's usually also as a reaction to something larger going on in the world,
for sure,
some sort of chaos or anxiety or maybe even something positive.
Yeah. I mean, I came to New York because I came to work for the Museum of Modern Art for a year, and then the ICA in Boston as a curator, as a creative director around digitizing their assets. They had learned about us from... We were in San Francisco. They came to visit us. Mm-hmm. And then my bug for films did not leave me, because I had written a lot of movie scripts. You know, you're always trying to get your film made and
take a meeting.
Take a meeting, attach this star to your project and whatnot. So, in time, as the, with Final Cut Pro and with these new cameras, really, much of what the overhead of would cost to make movies became more available. And since I had been trained as a filmmaker and as a writer, coming to New York, gathering actors around me, which I love, was really allowed me to start working through a way to make these independent films. And I wind up making a number of these very independent films. But as I said to you, even in our correspondence, like getting them seen is, I think, the challenge for a lot of filmmakers.
Absolutely. Today. Even the more conventional or commercial, those that gravitate in that direction are having a hard time, let alone, someone who isn't. So, or taking a more kind of unconventional path in there. Yeah, it's very true. You know, that's a combination of just lack of spaces out there, and also of, you know, just the sheer amount of content that's coming out from everybody, you know? So it's a real, real challenge, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And to make a living, of course, as an extension of that, right?
Yeah.
So it's like a lot of filmmakers now seem like they're getting their version of what was, you know, a theatrical and a festival circuit type of situation, you know, and there, you know, seem to be a lot of festivals and showcases and film series picking up the slack a little bit too. They just seem to kind of be popping up all over the place all the time.
Yeah. Is that what you're primarily doing, talking to filmmakers?
Primarily, but I've opened it up quite a bit. And, you know, of course, I'm always trying to get higher profile people on and to help with, you know, expanding the audience. I will always remain loyal to the underdogs, well, or emerging filmmaker or emerging artists, whatever it is. I'm trying to kind of open up the conversation quite a bit. So, you know, you're coming on is a good thing, because you are also, since you're working in different disciplines, it's nice to be able to open up the show a bit more, you know, whenever possible.
Yeah.
Did you ever get invited or did you ever go back or to that place? Or
no, I mean, no, but I haven't, you know, I'm not, I'm so often just working on stuff, but
yeah, that other part of it is
not working
is not
as much as like okay, the, yeah, to you know. That's why I was just curious. It's like for your program, you know, it'd be interesting to have a program with a group of film curators.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are they, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And I do. Yeah. I mean, I try whenever possible to invite on. I've had on quite a number over the years.
Yeah.
You know, and programmers. I you know, the guy at for instance, I would Jed.
Yeah,
at,
Jed.
At Film Anthology.
Yeah.
I'd love to have him on. I think he'd be a great guest.
Yeah,
you know, just because
yeah.
of the history of the Film Anthology archives and that now that he's like programming stuff there, right? So yeah, it would be interesting. That would be for whomever.
Yeah.
Karen Cooper.
Yeah.
That's another one I'd like to bring on.
Yeah.
And on and on. Not just New York institutions. And wasn't it I'm gonna stumble on her name.
Johanna Schiller.
Was it Johanna?
Yeah.
Oh, right. It was Johanna.
Yeah.
I was trying to remember who put us together. Johanna, that's right. She produced that documentary back then, right?
Yeah.
That's right. She's also a producer at Criterion, or she was?
She was. Her husband's there. They were
He's
both
there
at one point. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, well, I wanted to tell you a little bit about how I made some of these films,
mm-hmm.
which, you know.
Technique-wise?
Not so much technique-wise, but I know that we're always hearing that there's just a glut, what a word, of films. You know, there's so many films out there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you think of, I mean, certain, like, I think there might be, and you'll probably know more than I, because I realize I'm not very much a part of the film community.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really realize that. I mean, I've had such a love of film, and I think a real knowledge of film that I didn't, but I didn't realize that there was a community of discourse of people around film with maybe different stakes in it or something, as much as I feel like I'm having a dialogue with film itself. But, you know, there's a period of film where people, they so much wanted these smaller recording instruments. They wanted to make more intimate films. So, you know, starting with like Cassavetes, there's this whole period that says, okay, we can make the Godard films all the way. People feel like the 70s was this great period of filmmaking, the mid-60s to the 70s. Then you kind of got the independent cinema and queer cinema. And then you got the 90s, Tarantino, you know, the outliers, the Sundance filmmakers that they got absorbed into. Then a lot of people like Ted Hope and Shame, they try to figure out, or they kept feeding the studios, and the studios sort of absorbed them and couldn't kind of really mount a different, then they did different kind of, I don't know, programming in theaters where, well, we'll have this in for an evening, we'll have this, we'll rotate it. So the idea like of cinema becoming more like a novel, well, what would that mean? More something that's very independently produced but could find a readership or a viewership,
mm-hmm.
or an audience, seems to elude everyone. So I wouldn't just go back to me. What I eventually found was the way I used to make films, or you're taught to make films, is that you don't necessarily storyboard the film, but you board the film. What does that mean? You had these green stripes, and it said, this film's going to be a 30-day shoot. This is, you know, 18 days to shoot, because every day costs this amount of money, or it's a big film, you're going to get
right.
6 months to shoot, 8 months to shoot. And what you do is, once you secure this talent, and this talent had to be bankable, so it would ensure the return on investment, then you would find all these locations, or you'd produce these sets. And I got to the point, of course, I was taught the same way to do it. And mm-hmm. You always, everyone winds up chasing in the independent circle the very few bankable independent actors
mm-hmm.
that change in 3 years. You don't even remember who they are 8 years ago, who was really bankable to get this film. But another part of the talent was you always started with the location that said exterior night, you know, Adams, you know, mm-hmm. Studio.
Mm-hmm.
But what I realized over time was I was doing this class where the were actors for camera. And I saw that the students were like, they really wanted to get on and make a film. And since I had a number of movie scripts, I had this one script that I said, you know, I'm not going to write any more movie scripts. I'll write this like as a novella. I had a short, but I gave it, I started bringing the pages to the script, and wherever the location was, I said, yeah, let's just go in the hallway. Let's go up there. Let's just go around the block to this delicatessen. Mm-hmm. And I realized in a way it sort of didn't matter. It wasn't so, and you suddenly have your camera and mm-hmm. you can record and you're on the streets of New York and there's extras and you go into this place and you just shoot. And from that time on, I would spend a lot of time with the actors getting close, understanding what the material is. We'd say, we'd just find an area like, okay, about 23rd in Manhattan. No, then I decided I'm going to make the whole film in one location at the park. So I made my film Paradise. There's so many different places inside the park.
Right.
So it's like that psycho-simio taxiplasm, which is that kind of film. You're going to make it in this location. You have no borders. You can shoot so that once you get over that you need this location, so then the next movie I said, I want to shoot it in Manhattan. I want to shoot it in the city. So I shot it all near 24th Street. And before you know it, you're on the street, you're shooting, then you have people shooting themselves, and you could mount a production and be very flexible without this everything pre-planned, everything boarded. You're very kind, and you're giving you like this movie 27, I said, okay, I'm going to interview the actors. I'm going to find out who they are as people. I'm going to script it. But then I'm going to say, you know, Adam's kind of interesting. He's into this. And you start adapting the role to them. And you start placing him in the film. So suddenly you're making a film that it's not location dependent. It's not star dependent. It's definitely narratively driven, though. It's definitely, but it. And then I start to realize, like in this 27, everyone is so accustomed to being on camera. Everyone is so constantly recording themselves that the film becomes almost a social media platform to put on a film. It's almost like everyone knows what a film is. Okay, we know what they know what to do once you say we'll be filming. So you show up at St. Mark's Bookstore in this last film, camera person's in there. Of course, the book owner says, you know, are you going to be here long? No, we're going to get ready. And you're rolling, you're shooting 5D, you have the audio. And you walk down the street and you walk over here and the movies, these movies that I've made, like eight feature movies, are very sort of organic to a small group. Usually I can shoot a second camera, someone who's a good camera person as well shooting, someone doing sound, and that's it. And the actors, there's nothing but their enthusiasm and ability to kind of stretch and play with the thematic material you're into. So suddenly now you are making, I am, and I'm sure others are making these films that, like I said, is more akin to sort of like a novel. It's intimate, it's smaller. You don't know who the actors are. You don't know, you sometimes can't license the music. So at first I didn't use any tracks. But now I've said, you know, my movies aren't really going to be seen, so I'll use some pop music, which really carries a movie too. You realize, wow, the power of these songs. And then after a while, let's say you submit to Berlin or you submit to this festival and you start seeing that you're, the people that are these festivals really there to discover new things, or are they really there as a platform to promote more? You never know what the
reality
of
itself.
Like
the
you said,
festival.
Eventually you scale up. You want to bring on the show people that have audiences, the people that might bring their audiences to the show or to the festival.
Yeah.
So, in all that, I'm trying to say, I don't know yet that we found a way like Grove Press or some independent publishing imprint that can itself have the audience and bring to that audience new filmmakers rather than the film incumbent upon the filmmaker to be discovered, to be found. And I mean, are there great films out there? Is there interesting work out there we'll just never see? You might know more than me, but I think I'm unusual in the way that I, you know, what I did for myself. I said, you know, at first, at the beginning films, I would bring like eight people to my house here, 10 people, and watch the film together. You could tell, is it slow? Is it working?
Right.
See, because you want, if you make the film, you want to have that relationship and have it seen, like I said, having
sure.
the film play at 27, playing at 27, for example, playing an anthology is really fantastic because you commune with the audience.
Right, right,
you
right.
get something. Now, could you repeat that 50 times and go to San Sebastian and go there? And then you start submitting. Some of these festivals are $200 to submit. You go, wow, right. I spend less than $1,000 making my film, but I'm going to spend thousands of dollars submitting my film. And after all, I said, you know, I see that the film plays. It's like applying for grants. You just capitulate. So that's just to tell you in a long way. I have a bug to even make another film, but I know going in, there is no financial gain, and it's more an experience for us.
Right.
And they are, to me, very accessible, interesting films coming out, you know, but you just think, well, what's going to happen to them?
What will the life of these look like? And you're making them and then putting them away in a drawer, and it almost
because after a while, you, as a filmmaker, you know so many people from your film school. Growing up, you walk on the street. I'm raising money for that.
Yeah,
I've been working on this film for 6 years,
and
that just is. I mean, life changes so quickly, and our feelings do. That's hard to hang on to something for that long a period of time and make it really alive to you, realize it in a way that I've liked this way of filmmaking because it's very intense.
Right.
You're collecting a lot of energy and you're really articulating it
And it, the whole time it's still it's always charged, so
there's
no staleness to it
because
it's gone before you. I know that, like, talking to Kaveh. Do you know Kaveh, too?
Yeah.
You know, he's now trying to make something a little bit more big budget, actually, for
change. Yeah,
I have
several friends like that. They get into that mode,
Yeah, well, you know, but I think part of it is the way what you were describing, and as you were describing this thing about trying to raise money, and it takes forever, and he does not like to go this Kickstarter direction at all. Like, he does not want to do that. He finds it really irksome to him. And so what is he going to do? But if he goes to the other side, that's not even part of the conversation. You can kickstart for a bigger budget film, but you know how that goes, and it doesn't really make sense for on the financial side. It's a lot of work.
If you can get the money up front and you can get some names, you definitely increase the chances that your film will be seen.
Right.
But then you will definitely make film became more over time a producer's medium. Few directors are strong enough to make the money come to them, so to speak, to really.
Yeah.
It becomes a product of notes and compromises. And sometimes you can get something with that, but there's very few people in the Hollywood business are really. And raising money is, you know, I have a friend, Nina Menkes, a very strong independent filmmaker as a woman. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like looking for that. You mean anywhere north of $200,000. You realize it's like, what am I really going to get for $200,000?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what do we need? 2 million, 5 million? And suddenly, you know, they say, I want to make 100. I want to make 200.
Mm-hmm.
So now, okay, even 10% of the budget, you got to get to 2 million. And so what's, 2 million is not enough. Well, now we need 5 million. Then now suddenly you've spent 5 or 8, which is small. Now we need to sell it as another 5 million.
Easily.
So there's like 13, 18 million at the lowest of the low end.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So even if someone picks up your film and you've made it for nothing, they're like, this is going to cost us $8 million just to get this thing known, someone to hear about it, that it might do a weekend, that we might sell it through.
Right. Yeah.
And then everybody, and then the whole of the forum of cinema, narrative film, independent filmmaker, all has to, and it's, you know, bend or adhere to this, the logic of the market.
Mm-hmm.
There's no independent cinema because we live in a culture of, you know, capital viability. It's viable.
Right. Any truly independent cinema is just in festivals. That's what I'm trying to say. Or now maybe digitally DIY.
Yeah, but
you know, and that's it. There's no theatrical. There's no. I mean, it's disappearing.
Well, I don't even know if it needs.
I agree.
Theatrical.
No,
way,
it's just reviews and awards.
Yeah.
I mean, the only reason anybody does a theatrical, well, I mean, there is of course an emotional experience with your audience for that first or second night.
Yeah.
But that's it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, people, I guess a lot of people just do it because they know they'll get the reviews, and they'll get, if indeed it's important, they can also get consideration for awards and things like that. I don't know why else. It's not worth it. It's too expensive, but the press is important, I guess.
Yeah. It just...
For everybody else out there playing the game.
Well, you know, of course a filmmaker wants awareness, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, this, you know, A.O. Scott, he's at the co-op, the Park Slope co-op.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen him a few times. And, of course, I felt, A.O., you have to see my film. When you hear my film, Tony's playing
say
so
Tony.
Well. Tony, come on.
Well, you know.
Anyway, you try to put it in one hand. It's like, mm-hmm. is there, there's something, it's that thing. It doesn't exist if no one knows about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I know, yeah.
But what drives you
well.
To do it?
Yeah. Where are we at? Just keep an eye on the time. First of all, people can get the book Everyday Cinema.
Yeah. On Amazon.
They can get it on Amazon or wherever books are sold.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your website is marklafia.com. You can check out anything related.
Films there. There are a number of films there. Too.
And your films.
Yes.
Of various lengths? Or
Yeah.
Okay. And now... 27, or do you have any more screenings planned
yet?
Or
set up yet.
Set up yet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll keep people abreast if you do decide to. And actually...
One at the ICA, maybe. There was a conversation in London to play there. Yeah.
Very good. Well, the ICA in Boston?
No, there's an ICA,
In Britain and UK as well.
Yeah.
By the way, one other thing we should mention, do you know Brick? Brooklyn Independent Media? Do you know about them?
Yeah.
The Brick House?
Yeah.
It's like an arts media center.
Yeah.
Near BAM.
Does it have like an independent television channel?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
That's what I do with them. I actually, one of my gigs is I've been doing a very bad job until now. I'm actually stepping up and they want content for their channel. They have a high def channel which is curated by Brick. So it's not and one of the film curators is me.
Okay.
They want content for that channel, and so the only requirement, which is kind of probably a soft requirement, is there's a Brooklyn-related thing. Well, guess what? You live in Brooklyn, so that's about all you need.
Okay.
So if there's maybe we can find one of your films and show it on the channel.
Sure.
And then you could also come on if you so choose to. We could do something on there like like a little interview about it or about what we've been talking about, shorter.
Sure.
But on their channel.
Okay.
Because I do also,
all right.
I can do that.
Sure.
And we could show 27 or we could show something else.
Yeah. Okay.
Nothing that, you know, most of the times the conversation is, well, you know, I have a distribution, so they don't want me to do a broadcast or, you know, or this would mean that I couldn't show the film somewhere if it's broadcasting in Brooklyn somewhere.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sound like that might be an issue.
Okay.
For you necessarily, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So why don't we do that?
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks, Mark.
Thank you very much. Great to see you.
Same here.
Yeah,
we don't need
coming.
To wait two or three years again.
Okay.
Till next time.
All right. Okay. Good.
Great. Thanks. One of the most fun things for me to do every year is go to South by Southwest. Yes, sir, you see lots of films and other types of panels and whatnot, music and this and that. But for me, it's a social time. And I get to spend some time with people who I don't get to see the rest of the year. And these two guys are among my favorites. They're beautiful, lovely, funny people. You know, they have a language they share. They have a shorthand. Just to give you an idea of how much these guys work. And Heather, by the way, has been working since she was a tot, as she'll tell you about. And then Heather's going to be back little later on in the summer, maybe in the fall, with a one-on-one conversation that I did with her as well. But just looking over her IMDb page, there's just tons and tons of films here that she's played either minor or significant roles in, including the 2003 Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I now must make sure I get to watch. She's done a lot of television, too. My goodness, she's been busy. She's done tons of short films. Well, she came onto my radar in 2010 with Lovers of Hate, which co-starred her friend and mine, Chris Dubeck, and Alex Kirkpofsky. She was the Chris Dubeck's, I guess, ex and Alex Karpovsky's current love interest. And they play brothers, so that got sticky. She was in Wuss, my friend Clay's film. She was in Slacker 2011, which was this interesting, I guess, remake or reimagining of course, the legend, the iconic film. She was in Kid Thing, which was the Zellner Brothers film. Ain't Them Body Saints, Pit Stop, Loves Her Gun, Love and Air Sex. All these films, by the way, I have had segments on, or for, rather, subsequently. And Joe, which was, of course, David Gordon Green's film. I got to go back and watch that. But now that I have all these films here, pretty much. And I just caught her in a new film, Some Beasts, which I hope comes out soon. We have that filmmaker on. I have a segment ready to post anytime once that film comes out. And my friend Frank Mosley's in it, and we have an interview with him. We have an interview with the director of Some Beasts. We have an interview with Heather, so we can hold up all those until maybe Some Beasts has a plan. But in the meantime, the newest credit that Heather has on her IMDb page is Untitled Terrence Malick Project. That's a good place. That's pretty cool. Johnny Mars. Among the many things he does, he's also a regular actor in many independent films, including, let's see here. He was in, we're going to skip through the shorts, The Happy Poet, which is a lovely film you can stream off Netflix. I recommend it. Chris Dubeck is in that as well. He was in Wuss, which I already talked about. Heather was in that. Slacker 2011 with Heather, which he was in that. Hellion, which is a terrific film. Somebody Up There Likes Me, which is a Bob Byington film. Pit Stop as well, which is Yen Tan's film, which Heather was in. Computer Chess, which, you know, Andrew Bajalski's film. Andrew was on with that. He was in Good Night. That's when Johnny came on. In 2013, Johnny came on to talk about that film, Good Night, when he was in that. We did a segment on that film. He also has parts in Joe and Hellion, and just, it's a pretty incredible. So, and he's in a bunch of new stuff coming up as well. So let's go into the conversation. Heather Kafka and Johnny Mars.
What I'm concerned about is having insulted an entire swath of people who are out there working hard, serving food to asshats in LA,
right,
on the daily.
But I feel like you were like criticizing the service industry in LA. That was the vibe I got.
Well, okay, yeah, copy that.
Okay, so,
but not the servers.
No.
I'm gonna. Let me organize.
We're going to wrap it up now.
No, not remotely. No. We're just starting on. No. And wow. Technically, we're just starting. Heather Kafka.
Way to bring it down.
I'm sitting with. No, let's do this a little bit more organized, because for those who don't know you both, I think this would be, you know, I think for Austin folks, this is going to be funny. You know, but we also need to remember that. So Johnny Mars, actor, filmmaker, has done about, I think, 70
to 70 million plus movies.
A lot of movies.
Yeah.
Majority out of
mostly
Austin.
Mostly out of Texas.
Mostly out of Texas. So Dallas, Austin, what have you.
Sure.
Right.
I got my Walker, Texas Ranger on that resume. Don't.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, don't forget about Chuck.
Sorry about that.
You got to go through the almighty gates of Chuck.
Chuck, right. That's
you don't
a separate.
Want to piss him off. That's
a whole.
Sure.
That's a whole other podcast. But I do want to know what. And then Heather, how many? Heather, also, you're based here in Austin. How many? Roughly, how many films do you think you might have? Is it that many? When was your first? Or roughly, when did you?
My first acting experience, period, or
no, like the first, like what your first? I don't know, film where you. It was a real, yeah, like the first film. I don't know.
I can't. Because here's the thing is I've been acting since I was 6 years old.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
I'm now very old.
Whoever old you are, I'm probably another 10 years older.
I'm so... I'm. So,
she's the most beautiful 29 again woman I've seen in a long time.
She's very old. I started acting when I was 6.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's hard for me to differentiate between, like,
yeah,
between acting and just being... Because it's always been, shut up, Johnny.
No, it's always been,
it's always been sort of tangled up in the mix.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so, well, you know, that clouds the memory a bit. But
so if I went to your IMDb page, though, you did some shorts.
There, it would actually be missing probably 25 things that I've done before that just never made it or whatever.
Okay.
But no, I started acting when I was 6. When I graduated high school, I moved to LA and went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. Mm-hmm. I graduated from that, and then I moved back and forth between Austin and LA for 10 to 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started in theater, and then, and then it was a lot of, like, TV movie stuff. That's kind of all that would come to Austin.
Mm-hmm.
It was that, like, Western sort of Laura Ingalls Wilder TV movie that you had to get on.
Right.
And then independent film started to happen. And and so, you know, I started to do some independent film. But then when I moved to L.A., I finally got a manager who was like... I know how to do this. And so what that meant was she pimped me out for the guest star circuit on the TV shows.
Okay. And you were a teenager by then, or?
No, I was in my 20s, late 20s.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then I came back here and I've just been like a steady stream of independent movies. What happened was actually the writers went on strike. My husband and I were living in Los Angeles, and we'd been married 10 years, and I thought if we were going to have a baby, we should do that now. Because I always feel like I've got bad timing. Like, I'm a really good dancer, and I have rhythm and all that kind of business, but timing in life, I always feel like I'm in the wrong place. Like, I was in L.A. when Rick was doing Dazed and all that kind of stuff, and I was in Austin when, you know, whatever was going on out there. It just was always... wrong place, wrong time. And I was like, hey, the writers are going to go on strike. Ain't nobody going to be doing shit for like a year.
Right.
Perfect time for me to be pregnant.
That is sort of, it sounds like a very practical choice to make.
It felt prudent.
Yeah. At the time. I understand.
So then we moved back here and had my daughter, and I haven't left. It really has become a very active time here as far as getting to work.
Yeah, right.
I did Lovers of Hate.
Oh,
right when I got back. Harper was about a year, and I booked Lovers of Hate, and we shot that.
Alex Karpovsky and Chris Dubeck.
And then Sundance. And then Brian Poyser, who's kind of like the epicenter of everything. You know, that was like the first time I really got on Facebook and all this, and it was just this like web that... of filmmakers and people.
Things exploded.
Yeah. And so then everybody was like, hey, will you do my film? Hey, will you do my film? And I was like, yes, of course. Yes, this is awesome.
Yeah. And then all the money was pouring in.
And then...
Johnny, what's your... We'll come back. Johnny, what was
Hi.
Your...
Hi. Welcome back. Filmax Radio.
Johnny, we were saying you were on some years ago for... Good night, but I remember I think that year at South by you were in like 5 films or something. So that was not untypical.
Seven? Yeah.
Oh wow. Okay. That's not untypical for
Was that year because I listened to Robert Longstreet's Filmax Radio. Yeah, and he was saying that he was tied with you at Sundance.
To the mic, yeah.
Yeah, Robert, well, this is a weird stat. Robert and I both have had 4 premieres at Sundance in a single year.
Wow.
I would give him the bump because all of his were features.
Oh.
Not all of mine were features. One was a short.
Okay.
But I'll also give Robert the bump because he's the man, Mr. Robert Longstreet. exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point.
Who I'm chasing, by the way. Yeah. I want to work with him really badly.
Sure. Well,
yeah, I want to work with Robert so badly. I've sat with producers trying to figure out movies we could be in together. Of course,
sure.
Of course, Heather. Of course, of course.
You're and he's not even that talented.
You're always on my list.
The irony is he's not even that talented.
If I can get you.
But he sort of...
He's not that talented.
No,
he's not. He's not. He's, I mean, that guy can't tie his shoes. Robert. No.
He's an idiot.
But you turn a camera on and it's...
Yeah. Right.
Like suddenly he can walk and talk and chew gum at the
but
same time.
But his thing is people want to work with him.
Yeah.
It's not
that he's
got particular talent. His talent is...
Because he's got the best drugs.
That, oh, my God. No, we can't say that. Cannot say that. He's trying to straighten...
Capital Girl,
he's
guys.
He's straightening up... Right. He's straightening up... yeah, I got to keep my sponsor. I got to keep the capital coming in.
Yeah,
you know
what
I'm saying? Anyway, but let's not talk about Robert Longstreet. I like that.
He is a beautiful man, though. He is awesome.
Yes,
he's awesome. And there is like, there's a group of people amongst the circuit, Heather, Robert included, Chris Dubeck, amongst others, that I love. You know, I would love for us all to make like some kind of movie together, some sort of like greatest hits of like the indie stars. I don't know what, like just people, you know, the people that you see on the circuit
the
all the time.
The Austin indie all stars.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, doesn't even have to be Austin specific. Just, you know, the
character.
Yeah. The stars that we see, you know, we were hanging with Lindsay Burge last night, who I love.
Oh, were you at the creative control party? Or because I saw her there.
Yeah. We walked over there together and she was, her and I did a teacher together. I played her brother in a teacher.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
That's right. You were in a very early scene in teacher.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. She's amazing to work with and we've become friends, you know, ever since over the years. And I would love to figure out a way for all of us to get in front of a camera doing something fun together. Paul Swallow.
Who's that?
Paul Swallow, man. Christine. Do you know Christine? It's his alter ego.
Is that how you say his name?
Christine. Paul Swallow. Yeah.
No, it's
I'm pretty sure it's a play on the word swallow.
I thought they said Paul Swallows. It's a whole other.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's Swallow, yeah.
Okay.
Paul's amazing. He's an entertainer who cross-dresses often. One of his characters is Christine.
Mm-hmm.
They do he goes on tour. He's opening up for Faith No More.
Mm-hmm.
In a few weeks, his show is. Yeah. They're doing three dates in the Northwest. He's an amazing guy. He was in Out of Sight. He's in George Clooney's Out of Sight.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's Steven Soderbergh's Out of Sight.
I mean, he quit. He quit the business. We don't talk about him anymore.
Yeah, right.
He's retired.
His name comes off all the product.
Yeah, it's been erased from history. but he is the prison bitch in Out of Sight.
I don't remember.
One of the guys in prison, was it Lewis? I don't remember now, but he's the prison bitch in that movie. Anyway, he's amazing.
Okay.
But, Paul Swallow's amazing. Anyway, my point being, like, there's all these great people that are out in the scene that aren't necessarily being exploited cinematically. That would be amazing to get all together and exploit the hell out of.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, say that again.
A little bit exploited. Maybe not in the right way.
Yeah. Well, let's exploit them properly. You know, I'm into that, but I don't know where this is going, Adam. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I love the idea. You kind of did that.
Why are you? Your eyes are glazed over a little bit.
No way. There was that reimagining of the Slacker in 2011, right?
Yes.
There was that, and that was kind of like a lot of folks were in that.
Yeah,
sort of. It was just about everybody.
Yeah.
Were you in that, Heather?
I was.
See. You were in it, yeah.
Yeah.
I gotta watch it again now because I since the last time I watched it, which was right after that it came out, I haven't seen it. Probably now would recognize.
But can anybody watch it?
I had at one point. Maybe I had a link to it. I don't remember.
I'd love it if people could see it. It actually turned out a hell of a lot better than I thought it could.
Somebody should put it on Vimeo. Maybe it would be. I don't know. It's called.
It was a remake of
Slacker, kind of almost shot.
Yeah, it was a remake of Slacker, and the idea was the rules were you were going to reimagine the scenes and pass them off the same way Slacker did to the next director, but the whole point was to go back to those locations, how they exist now, if you can.
Yeah.
So it was interesting. That's an interesting experiment just on, you know, the evolution of this city and, you know, how it's changing.
Right.
But those were basically the rules, I believe. And then you had to get with the director of the short you were picking up or you were passing off to to figure out how that transitional element would work.
Well, one thing was that it used every scene used a different director, like the local directors here, like Karen Skloss. Spencer Parsons. And then they used a lot of local talent.
Right.
It was a really great thing. I liked it.
Yeah, me too. I thought it was cool. It was a really great way to get the scene together and just kind of, you know, one of the great things about Austin is, or let's just say Texas, actually, is this big communal spirit for indie film. And that's the, it's like to Heather's point earlier, it's like the scene began to emerge here and you can stay busy. I don't know that you'll pay your bills acting. I mean, that's a real statement. You know, right. Heather and I do other things. I work behind the camera. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but there's you can get dirty. Like, there's stuff you can do if you want to do it. And for me, the drug is being on set. I love acting. I've been an actor since I was 8 years old. That's never going to change. Whether or not I get to do that the rest of my life is kind of up to me. Whether or not I get to do it as a career is not up to me. So, you know, if I was able to make that happen, that'd be amazing. But at the same time, I just love being on set. And it's just this, yeah. You know, this great experience of being around all, you know, all the people that are drawn to it. Right. And the experiences you have making movies, TV shows, whatever, is undeniably interesting and specific and inspirational, and it's just problem solving on such a grand scale. It's really amazing to just be a part of, and it's like a drug almost, you know.
I heard like Chuck Norris almost word for word so they explained the experience the same way.
Chuck Norris.
Yeah, he explained it almost exactly.
But Chuck Norris, I've worked with Chuck Norris.
I know you made a reference to it.
I'm gonna name drop here. But doesn't Chuck's brother do everything? Isn't Aaron the guy that does everything?
I don't even know what that is or what you're talking about. Yeah, sorry. That's way too local for
oh,
me.
Oh, sorry.
I just, Chuck Norris is that, you know, sort of.
He's a bad, bad man.
Does a lot of, is he?
Well, yes.
He does infomercials, as far as I know.
That's yeah, and he's a heavy supporter of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
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 So I think that kind of makes him Darth Vader.
Yeah.
Now, this is an 80s era. Yeah. Republicans. I'm talking about right now.
Right.
The craziness that's right. being, you know, thrown out from that party. This yeah. guy's got a front row center ticket
right.
for.
Yeah, the extreme right, we yeah. call it now. We don't even call it Republican. The extreme right fraction, the Tea Party.
Yeah, him and Ted and Meatloaf all on the same stage.
Meatloaf too?
Say that again.
Meatloaf?
So great. See how good she is? Take two. Hit that. Same inflection, everything. One more time.
Meatloaf?
See how good she is? So
multi-take,
good.
Multi-take yeah. Kafka.
Actually, I'm called one-take Kafka.
Oh.
That's what she said.
Okay. Can I ask you, it is South by Southwest. Do you have work, any either of you, right now in the 2015 festival?
We both have a short in the same program. We're in two different shorts. I'm in a short called Woman of the World, and it's in the Texas Shorts program.
Oh, very good.
I'm in a short called The Samaritans, and it's also in the Texas Shorts program.
Okay, I'm going to make sure we'll make sure to figure out how. They might be on the online library that they've given us the keys to.
That I don't know.
Yeah, I'll figure that out. It would be nice. To
yeah.
Okay.
John Bryant directed it. Mark Reeb is in it. Uh-huh. Bill Wise is in it.
Oh, Bill Wise.
Yeah.
Because you know, the missing from our conversation is Chris Dubeck, who has been on the show, but it wouldn't have been nice for him to show up.
He would have brought a salad.
And he might have brought. He was talking
helpful.
About.
He that would have been helpful.
This is
I'm
how far afield he is. He was not only wanting to be here and planning on being here today with us, but he was talking about bringing Bill Wise with him.
Oh, so because he's staying at Bill's right now.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah.
Okay. Which is a bit north of here, I guess. So.
Yeah. Well, and he actually isn't living here right now. I think he's living in Copper's Cove.
Okay.
Where he's working.
All right.
So he drove in for the fest.
All right. Well, it's a disappointment, but we'll look forward to a
but
future
we love him
next year maybe.
So or, much.
Yeah. No, terrific. And I've already seen him in a couple of things.
Yeah, he has a few things does. Playing this year. Something in competition. Krisha, both Bill.
Oh, is he in that?
Bill and Chris both are in it.
I have to see that actually because the filmmaker contacted me, you know, through my website, like through an email through my website. Like, you know, are you, if you're there, come, you know. And I'm like, I looked at the trailer and it looked really great. So I said, yeah, let's give.
You know what else? I'm pretty sure he's in Micah McGee's Petting Zoo.
Yes, he is. He told me he was in Petting Zoo. So, and then was there some project you said that you were all working on together? No?
That's just kind of a dream.
No,
I mean,
when you were talking about it, I get that. I just thought maybe even there was something.
There is. That's right. So I wrote and directed a movie last year that okay. we're finishing now. Yeah, it's called Focus Puller.
That's it. That's yeah, yeah. And, I saw the face page.
Yeah, we just launched our social media. We've been doing that, walking around, handing out stuff, trying to launch our social media empire. I'll go ahead and call it that. Social Media Empire.
So it's a miniseries?
There's Twitter, and then there's Focus Puller, The Empire.
Who calls anything? Is it on...
It's a movie. It's a movie. Okay. I hope it makes it to TV. I mean, that's kind of like the goal.
Sure.
You can stream this on the interwebs.
But that would be... It's not a web series. And a web series would
this
also
is an
be...
honest-to-God feature film.
Right.
It's 84 minutes long.
Understood.
There's people in it. They talk on camera. They wear costumes. It's fun. Chris Dubeck and Heather Kafka have some amazing cameos in it. I am myself am in it. It's a psychological satirical monster movie. Okay. And it all takes place on a B movie set amongst a B movie set cast and crew.
Right.
And you know,
people start disappearing.
Well, on some level, yeah. There's this horrific accident on set, and the first assistant camera gets shot in the face by a blank gun, and so they replace her immediately because that's what we do.
Yeah, get rid of the body.
Yeah. And so they promote the second assistant camera to focus puller, and that puts him in the sights of the star of the film, Becca Mustaine, and she's like a an aging Lindsay Lohan type, fresh out of rehab, you know, claims that she was
Lindsay Lohan is the only aging Lindsay Lohan that we need. And
well, so. let's see if she's around long enough to be to be a type, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah. So anyway, she meets him. Finds out he's crazy. Crazy's useful in her world, and all hell breaks loose. So yeah.
Very good. And so, but why did you?
That was an amazing pitch.
It was great. I think you did a good job. Did you? Is there? But why did you present it to me before as a mini series? Because you were hoping to. Break it up into segments?
No, that was a joke.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Because nobody makes a miniseries. Yeah.
That's right. It's like it's gone
to
out
your
of the
point.
Lexicon.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you could. They do on HBO. They still make miniseries. I mean, they do like they did a multi-part, two or three parts.
The Jinx.
That might be considered.
That's one of them.
Yeah, that's
I guess
seven
so.
Part.
It's four.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. And then they, but they even, what was the Todd Haynes one when he remade the Joan Crawford film. About where she's the mother, the spoiled girl. Anyway,
no more wire hangers.
No, not that. Todd Haynes. Yeah. It was with Kate. Winslet played the Joan Crawford part, and she's the opens up a cake shop or a bakery, and she ends up. This is a great. It's really good.
I think Adam made this up.
No.
I
made it up. It's just easier.
I want to know what this is.
It's on HBO.
I need to make
somebody
more
call
money
in right
so I can
now.
Get HBO.
Oh, shit, it's not live. That'd be great. Or tweet in. No, I could just go on the.
We can do the tweeters.
Yeah.
All my tweeters out there.
Tweet, tweet.
Let's see. We will be tweeting that you guys are on the show. That's for freaking sure.
Nobody's kind of cuter than Adam with all his gadgets in his hand. He's got his phone and his microphone.
This
and
is
his
what
headphones.
My producer should be doing. And I'm. Doing
I think you're
well.
Producing fine. You look like you've got everything under control.
I do.
Look at that.
Here it is. Not far from heaven. Mildred Pierce. TV miniseries, 2011.
Yeah.
While you jokesters, you clowns were making the remake of Slacker. Todd Haynes was making Mildred Pierce.
Yeah.
And a remake. It was the original movie. It's incredible. Joan Crawford. She's sympathetic in that one because her daughter is this conniving. She has two daughters, and one of them is a really conniving, and the other one's a sweet kid. And she's always been, like, at the kind of manipulative. Oh, I took some pictures, too. So
oh, good. I took some of you guys just to prove that we were all here.
We'll have to get one together, all of us. But
you jump on board because I was the only one who hadn't.
We got five more minutes. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Maybe we can do more later. I'm here through Tuesday, leave Wednesday.
I'll chat with you more later.
Okay.
I would love to.
I got to drive to Dallas today because I booked a role on Mike White's new pilot for HBO.
What?
We're shooting in Dallas. Yeah. So I get to do it. Yeah, thanks.
Mike
but
White's
I get to
great.
Do it. Mike White's doing a new pilot for HBO called Mama Dallas, and I booked
he's
a
doing,
role on that.
He's doing what?
It's a new... It's an HBO pilot called Mama Dallas.
Yeah.
And hopefully it gets picked up and, they... We continue to shoot here in Texas. It'd be great. Leftovers is coming here. The other HBO series is going to be start shooting here soon.
That's true.
So there's lots of great stuff happening. Yeah, it's exciting.
You plant seeds with Mike White. Let him know about what I'm doing because I'd love to have Mike White on the show.
I think Mike White and I are going to bro down a lot on Filmwax Radio and like what Adam Shartop's up to.
All right.
I could
podcast the entire production, like just a podcast.
We'll tell you what.
There's a guy
I'll see if I can get 10 minutes with him in my trailer, and I'll be Adam Shartoff.
Okay. And my avatar?
Yeah, I'll be your avatar, and I'll get a quick little interview with Mike, and then you just cut me out of all the questions I ask and put your voice.
Oh, interesting.
And then it's in this Filmwax Radio.
That is almost... Yeah, that's brilliant, actually, is what that is. I don't know why I didn't think of this long ago. Why do I even have to do that? Why don't I take existing interviews, download them, and do it like me interviewing... Like Sidney Poitier, you know? Oh, Sidney, welcome back to Filmwax Radio. You know, thank you.
Yeah.
Adam.
Yeah. Why not? Why not?
It would be pretty funny.
It would be great.
Yeah. That's right. I have Douglas Sirk is going to be on the next episode of Filmwax Radio. So you both have shorts, and then you're going to be working with Mike White on this HBO.
Yeah, I get to do it tomorrow. I'm really excited about it. Yeah, it'll be great.
Heather? Do you have anything coming up that you're going to be working on yet, or you have anything set up?
I do.
Oh, wonderful.
I do. I don't know. I'm sure I can announce this. I don't know when you're putting it out.
I'll wait. Hey, great.
With ideas. With ideas.
Sorry, that was very good.
The pause gets
good.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Very well done. Well done, old boy.
It's all good. No, I did a film, a feature that we shot 2 years ago. In rural Virginia, mm-hmm. where we would go visit every season. I think it'll be okay. Because DIFF is in April. Okay, cool. Right?
Yeah, what is?
It's right around the corner.
Which festival?
Dallas.
Oh, Dallas.
Okay, so the film is called Some Beasts. Mm-hmm. And it's written and directed by Cameron Nelson. Stars Frank Mosley, myself, and Lindsay Burge.
Yeah.
And we shot every season a little bit in rural Virginia.
Oh, nice.
And it's shot by Hutch.
Yeah, I know Hutch. He worked with Yen Tan.
Yes, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful film. And I'm really proud of it. And so I'm super excited that it's going to co-premiere, I think he called it, in narrative competition.
Is that your daughter?
It's my baby girl. In the narrative competition at Dallas Film Festival and at Nashville.
That's Frank Mosley's his territory. Really? Like he's in position.
It's just,
well, I know Frank was supposed to be here too, by the way, speaking of, if not local, he's state.
He was going to do this podcast also? How many people were you going to get on this podcast?
Frank, I
got
to
get more mics, Adam.
I know. That's for fucking sure. I have to get, but that requires then a mixing board, it requires a bigger setup. Right, that's the problem. So, but I won't. Can you imagine if Chris was here? He'd just be sitting
nice
over there
intern.
Having, like, you know, a glass of lemonade sitting by himself because he wouldn't get a word in. But it's very true about what you just said. In fact, it's the equipment, is a big issue because I want to get better mics. I want to the thing is, if you have to go up to one more, you have to have a different whole other setup. So you have to have, like, either a mixing board or something that. You can plug in more mics. Just do it on that.
No, I'm saying I was showing you at the time.
Oh, the time. Thank you. Oh, very good. Thank you.
Well, I'm an AD also. I make a living as a first assistant director.
Really fucking good AD, actually.
I've been sitting with, and this is, we've just been caffeinating, so forgive us if we came off a little bit shaky and, no, we're awake.
Actually but, edgy and shivering. And
oh, are you cold?
I'm sweating.
She's
right
a
now.
Little thing.
Freezing.
But it's my first time meeting Heather Kafka here in Austin, Texas. I appreciate your coming out and doing this with me. And we, maybe if I meet with Chris later, sit with that one too.
I would love to.
Let's do that.
I would love to.
Because I don't need Chris on his own. I did that. I'm not, what am I? It's not fun.
I would love to. I'm super honored that
Johnny,
you asked me.
Oh, no, and no. I've been wanting it since I started.
There's
seriously.
So much I could just blab about.
I want to hear anecdotes. I do. But I have to leave.
I've made more movies with Chris than anyone on this planet. Him and I have been in more movies together.
Together, yes.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy to think about,
right?
Actually, how often we work together. And I hate his guts.
I love you, Chris.
That's right. The two of you won't appear on the same podcast.
I will always love you.
Thank you, Johnny Mars and Heather Kafka.
Thank you.
We'll
do this again.
Anytime. Okay. Anytime.
Thank you.
And thank you, Capital Grill.
Well done. Thanks,
everybody. I got a few people up to, who actually went and subscribed and who put in star ratings on iTunes. So what I did is the other day I was sitting. You'll hear the segment in a couple of days on the next episode where we're going to talk about a film called Runoff with the director Kimberly Levine and the actor Neil Huff, and we're going to get to that. But while we were there interviewing Kimberly's husband, Kurt Pitzer, who is the producer of the film, and myself, we put together a little tutorial. It's a very short tutorial. I just have to edit it a little bit. And in this tutorial, we're going to show you how you can go and subscribe on iTunes and leave a star rating and a comment. It takes no time. And so, but I thought, you know, maybe people just don't know how to do it. Maybe it's not something they're comfortable with and they don't know really where to do it. So this is going to give you the this will take you through it like a demo should. This will take you right through it in no time. And so we're going to post that in the next coming days as well. So there you go. But in the meantime, we're on Facebook. You just go to facebook.com/filmwaxradio. And we are also, of course, on Twitter. If you go to @filmwaxradio, and you can engage with us on our website, filmwaxradio.com. We're on Instagram. Everything you can think of, pretty much. Okay, so thank you so much, everybody. I'm getting out of here. This is Adam Shartoff, your friend and host of Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time, take it easy. In my secret life, in my secret life, in my secret life. This morning, you were moving so fast. Can't seem to loosen my grip on the past. And I miss you so much. There's no one inside.